It's time for Kennedy for Alabama, a political talk show where we discuss the real issues impacting our sweet home, Alabama. Your calls, comments, and texts are welcome at 251-343-0106.
I love this country as much, if not more, than you do. And don't you ever forget that.
And now your host, Robert Kennedy Jr.
TGIF. Thank God it's Friday. Good evening to the FM Talk 106.5 listening audience. My name is Robert Kennedy Jr., and this is Kennedy for Alabama. Thank you so much for tuning in to our episode on Friday, the 15th of January, 2021. We are really excited about tonight's program, so let's get to it. Tonight, we have three fantastic members of this evening's conversation team in studio and one on the phone. The first is Miss Aquilin Kennedy.
Hi, everyone.
Our chief brand strategist and my lovely wife. The second joining us in studio is Mr. Ben Harris.
Hey, everybody.
Who is chair of the Mobile County Democratic Executive Committee. And the third, who is currently on hold, is Mr. M.K. Palmore, assistant special agent in charge for the FBI, presently retired. And last, but no wise least, our good friend, Mr. Phil Bush, who is working the production board and keeping Kennedy for Alabama sounding good on the airwaves. So, how are you guys doing tonight?
We're fantastic.
Excellent.
Yeah, doing great.
Friday, thank God.
Yes, we have survived the second week of 2021, and we're all still here, happy and healthy. So that is definitely a good thing. So, Aquilin, tell me something good.
Two fantastic things. First and foremost, I must pay honor to all of my sorors of Alpha Kappa Alpha Sorority Incorporated. Today is our 113th Founders Day. So excited to celebrate that, especially with a very, very, very special soror today, and that is our vice president-elect, Sora Kamala Harris. So very,
wow.
Very excited. Very excited. It's a very special day. Second one, Africatown's story is one step closer to being told.
Oh, wow.
Don't know if you all been kind of following what's going on there with the Clotilda, but this week, I think it was on Monday, actually, a loan was approved, the contract was approved, to move forward with the Africatown Heritage House. So Sue is so excited about that. That's going to bring so much wonderful business and just interest in this area. So super excited.
Wow, that's absolutely great. So Aquilin, thank you for that. And happy Founders Day to all the ladies of Alpha Kappa Alpha Sorority Incorporated. So with that, we'll go to the agenda. In the top half of the hour, we'll discuss the events that occurred in the U.S. Capitol last week with Mr. M.K. Palmore. In the bottom half of the hour, we'll continue the conversation with analysis with Mr. Ben Harris. We'll open up the phone lines and respond to your phone calls and text messages. Now for the headlines. The first headline comes from AL.com. It reads, Heritage House Approved, Africatown Museum to Tell the Story of Slave Ship and Community. It was written by John Sharp and published on January 11, 2021. The second headline comes from CNN Politics. It reads, Kill him with his own gun. Police describe facing the mob at the Capitol. It was written by Mark Morales and published on January 15, 2021. And the final headline comes from AL.com. It reads, Tuberville says delay inauguration, but the date is set by the Constitution. It was written by Greg Garrison and published on January 15th, 2021. So, Ben, last week, wow, what a crazy series of events that ended up occurring.
Well, you never thought you'd see it in America. I certainly didn't.
Yeah, not at all, not at all. So, with that, we are going to go to the phone lines and see if we have somebody who is on. Hello, you're on the line with Kennedy for Alabama.
Hey, Bobby, this is M.K. Palmore.
Hey, Mr. M.K. Palmore, how are you doing this evening?
I'm doing well. I'm doing well, my friend. Thanks for having me on.
Hey, thanks for joining us. For the listening audience, Malcolm Palmore and I are classmates from the United States Naval Academy, class of 1992, and he is one of the individuals that I really wanted to reach out to and get a perspective on what happened last week. So, Malcolm, could you just take a brief amount of time here and just let the listening audience know about your background coming into this conversation, and then we'll jump right into some questions.
Sure, you bet. So I noticed at the top of the hour you introduced or talked about me as Assistant Special Agent in Charge for the FBI. I am a retired FBI executive. I spent 22 years in the FBI working a variety of matters. And additionally had the opportunity, as I like to say, to do everything that an FBI agent wants to do. You know, I worked straightforward investigations cases. I had time on FBI tactical teams and two field offices. I went into the management and executive ranks and ultimately led towards my retirement a team of cybersecurity investigative teams for FBI San Francisco. And I am now a cybersecurity strategic advisor in the private sector for a large-scale cybersecurity vendor in Silicon Valley. And as you indicated, also a U.S. veteran of the United States Marine Corps and a Naval Academy graduate.
All right, Malcolm. Well, thank you for providing us with that very detailed background. And part of the reason why I wanted to talk to you was a lot of times on Kennedy for Alabama, we dive into the political aspects of topics, and we don't always get the opportunity to tap into the subject matter expertise who is really looking at the situation within their experience base and able to offer commentary on some things that we should think about. So thank you for allowing me to have a conversation that is non-political in nature. Really appreciate it.
Yeah, you bet. You bet.
So when we were watching the events that happened in the Capitol and then kind of listening to some of the rumblings that were happening in personal conversations as well as what was happening online, the question that came up the most often was, you know, how can something like that happen? And so what I was hoping you could do is just take a little bit of time just to understand how resources are requested and assigned in a place like Washington, D.C., and why, quite frankly, there were so few people there at the beginning of the incident.
Yeah, so, I mean, there's a lot to pull back or a lot of threads to tease out there in the question that you asked. And so the first thing that folks have to understand, I guess, is sort of the myth that people have about how interconnected all of the law enforcement resources or military resources may be there within the district. And so what you have to understand is that you have an area, a very small area, where there are a number of federal agencies which have their own singular mandates.
Okay.
And are responsible for only certain aspects of, you know, the federal investigative or protection spectrum.
Okay.
In the instance of the incident at the Capitol, what you have is a police force only assigned to that small geographic region and responsible, obviously, for additional matters like protection of congressional members. But you have a small police force who I think, you know, at this stage we can all probably attest maybe a failure in planning. It doesn't appear that there was a lack of intelligence involved, but certainly once you've digested that intelligence, it does appear that maybe the correct asks were not made of the partner agencies there in the region in order to beef up resources there to better protect the Capitol and its resources.
Okay. So if, and I know it's hard to do this from the outside looking in, but if we were talking about, you know, hindsight being 2020, and in order for the resources to have been beefed up, what is it that the Capitol Police Organization would have had to do? Would they have had to ask for resources? Is that kind of the methodology that that happens?
Yeah, I mean, you know, everyone likes to watch TV and sort of see the myth of the FBI sort of stepping in and telling other agencies what it is that they're going to do in terms of overriding their capabilities. But nothing could be farther from the truth. You know, these law enforcement agencies work in coordination with one another, sort of all understanding their lanes and respective lanes and where they're supposed to be. So my guess, again, not having an insider's point of view, but having been involved in large-scale planning for events, I suspect that intelligence and information was provided to the leadership and intelligence apparatus of the Capitol Police. It was resources were offered by other agencies. In other words, do you want additional manpower on station to be responsible for certain aspects of protecting the surrounding area so that you can concentrate on what your primary mission is, which is you know, essentially the four corners of that property and then any access points and then what's going on in the interior. And it appears from all accounts that that help was offered, but at some point the leadership of the Capitol Police turned down the assistance.
Right, and I think that's a very important point here to highlight. And of course, at this stage, all of us are kind of speculating, right, because we don't know exactly what changed hands. But the notion of the FBI just coming into a situation and saying, yay, we're taking over, is more of an exception than a rule, kind of like a pop culture myth. Is that correct?
Yeah, pop culture myth. Certainly there are certain federal agencies that have very high level, sort of very focused, singular responsibility. Mm-hmm. The FBI is one of those agencies, of course, that has a very wide mandate. But at the same time, you know, their focus is typically on reactive matters, okay, investigative matters involving counterterrorism issues, espionage, the litany of white-collar crime issues, okay, that they investigate, of course, cybersecurity, which was the area that I retired from, and intelligence collection as it relates to international and domestic issues. But that is all done, of course, under legal mandate, and there are limitations in terms of what it is that they can do that have to, of course, align with U.S. constitutional law.
Okay, that makes perfect sense. So thank you for that explanation. Here's one question that was running through my mind based primarily on the images that we saw. So I want to create a little bit of a scenario, and I don't like doing a whole lot of hypotheticals, but I think it might help the audience just kind of understand when you are requested versus when you deploy. So the scenario that I wanted to add in was, what if you had a group of FBI agents who were actually doing their job in accordance with, you know, appropriate authorizations, and all of a sudden found themselves in a problem? In that type of situation, would there be more leeway for the FBI to deploy additional resources?
Absolutely. I mean, you know, one of the things or benefits from being a street agent in the FBI and also being a member of their tactical teams, that typically one of the things the Bureau enjoys is enough resources in order to accomplish the mission. So it's rare, extremely rare, that the FBI goes into a situation where it has not done a significant amount of planning and brings a significant amount of resources to the table so that they don't have to ask for help. In the scenario that you just outlined, though, if there are street agents out conducting interviews or, you know, conducting surveillance, and they find themselves in the midst of a tactical problem that they didn't plan for, then absolutely they can reach back out to the field office, reach back out to the operations center, and request additional resources. And the chances are, of course, since they're already deployed, they're already under, you know, constitutional mandate, they're engaged in their job, doing what they're supposed to do, that the FBI then can roll additional resources almost automatically to their location to provide additional assistance.
Okay. I think that's very important to highlight, and thank you for providing that explanation. So, okay, we've talked about the first part of the questions that pertain to the incident that happened there at the U.S. Capitol. The next set of questions become much more interesting because now the event has occurred. And one of the things I think is unique about this particular situation was the amount of video that we've seen, the amount of still pictures that we've seen, and the amount of forwards of social media posts, whether it's, you know, Facebook, Twitter, Parler, et cetera, et cetera. So from an investigative standpoint, what is it that folks are kind of looking to figure out as they're essentially processing that treasure trove of information?
Yeah, so this will be a all-hands-on-deck effort by the Bureau.
Okay.
You know, most people think of the Bureau in sort of terms that don't actually apply numbers. But so you have this workforce of roughly 40,000 people, of which 13,500, close to 14,000 are actual special agents that are, you know, sort of the tip of the spear and actually in the field for the Bureau. Mm-hmm. Included in that number, 40,000, of course, are intelligence analysts and others who support the overall mission. So what's going on right now for the FBI, again, all hands on deck in every field office throughout the country include FBI headquarters. And what you would find if you stepped into any field office likely would be Special Operations Center stood up for communications and centralizing the activity of that particular field office. You would find leads being generated from the photos, from the information that's being provided by folks who call in and provide, you know, either anonymous or named information related to the potential subjects in the investigation. And that will trickle out to probably all 56 FBI field offices. I suspect that, once we hear the postmortem in terms of the investigation that the FBI conducted, that you will hear that probably nearly every field office was involved sort of pulling the thread and making sure that we understand the full scope of the investigation. You know, one of the things I was proud of being in the Bureau is that, you know, certainly from a reactive standpoint, I do not believe there is an agency better qualified, better resourced, and more capable of really getting their hands wrapped around what transpired and then subsequently telling a story, which, of course, will result in, you know, potentially hundreds of individuals being indicted, maybe even thousands of individuals being indicted for their participation in that insurrection on the 6th.
Okay. So one of the things I think that's been interesting about sitting in this chair at this particular radio station is that our listening audience tends to skew conservative. And so I'm a bit of an anomaly being a Democrat who has a radio talk show on a conservative radio station. And so I have the opportunity to listen to some concerns that are expressed by the listening audience, and I'll give you one in particular. So the local group that went up there came under the umbrella of the Common Sense Campaign. We know the individual who led that particular group. He is a retired naval officer and also a conservative talk show host on this station. So some of the reporting that came out was not completely provided in context, but suffice it to say they had already left Washington, D.C. before any of the foolishness started, and they were actually on their way driving back home. But one of the things that a lot of folks are expressing, concern about is this distinction between the people who went to the Capitol and were kind of outside, if you will, doing the chants and stuff like that, versus people who actually breached, you know, the four walls of the Capitol building, some of whom were essentially tourists walking around taking pictures, and then, you know, what we would clearly define as the foolishness, right? People who are really hell-bent on death and destruction, right? And so how does the Bureau kind of go through and tease out to determine whether, you know, one, you know, the crime has occurred, and two, whether it's the big crime, big C crime, or the little C crime? How do they kind of go through that process?
Yeah, so great question, Bobby. So there's varying degrees of culpability in terms of what transpired. First of all, let's deal with the group, which it's hard to put in numbers. Clearly a large number of people who are just First Amendment folks out there expressing their opinion about something. If the evidence dictates that, those folks have nothing to worry about. No one's interested in pursuing anyone for pursuing their First Amendment rights.
Gotcha.
What happens, though, is that for the folks who are all, you know, part of that crowd, who then take and break through obstacles, and I mean both virtual obstacles and physical ones, to step into another level of culpability, or a different degree in terms of punitive measures where they might have violated some law, either a misdemeanor or felony-type violation, what the FBI is going to do is the same thing that they always do, and that's put together a case built on evidence based on the facts, which may include direct interviews, it may include digital evidence, any other factors or digital medium, anything that they can use to help support the investigation, and they will include and exclude subjects based on what the evidence tells them. And so, in quite a few of these instances, there's a lot of digital evidence with, you know, potential or alleged subjects on tape, sort of identifying the crime that they're engaged in, who they are, and so forth. And so, I mean, those individuals are going to have some steep obstacles to overcome,
sure,
in terms of proving their innocence. But for other individuals, some of that information, video information, will be exculpatory, and it will actually exclude them from further investigation. And so, yeah, these folks will be broken down into different groups. I feel confident that the FBI will not pursue, punitive investigation against anyone who is not Who has not, you know, broken a law or taken those steps which require an investigation to happen? And for the folks who didn't do anything and were expressing their First Amendment rights, again, honestly, I don't think they have anything to worry about.
Yeah, and that was really the part that I wanted to kind of hone in on, because I think it's important as it pertains to providing a level of comfort that nobody is on the proverbial witch hunt where they're trying to find someone because they expressed a political opinion which is squarely within the, you know, the four walls of their constitutional rights. It's truly looking for individuals who are committing crimes. Am I understanding that correctly?
No, absolutely. And I, you know, again, can attest certainly to the time that I was in the Bureau, the 22 years, and where I feel the culture of the organization is. You got an organization that's taken a little bit of a beating over the past 4 years, undeservedly. Mm-hmm. But I will tell you that every one of the individuals who swears an oath and puts on that that badge, carries those credentials, is engaged in a pursuit supportive of constitutional law. And that is what they do day in and day out. And they do it because that's their passion. That's the job that they want to do. And I feel comfortable about whatever outcomes come from that.
Right. Absolutely. So, Malcolm, as we predicted, you know, we've only gotten through the first two topics that we had on our list, and we have a little less than 3 minutes left. I actually want to take this conversation in a little bit of a different direction to wrap up. And that is, we are heading into Martin Luther King Jr. Federal Holiday Weekend. And yep. I just am thinking about where you are at this point in your career, where I am at this point in our career. Same thing here with Ben and Aquil and Phil as well. And I just, you know, wanted to give you the opportunity to share any thoughts you may have about this particular weekend.
Yeah, you bet. Thank you. So, I mean, today's the day that we honor. Certainly, you know, for the specific date, Dr. King's birthday, and, you know, we're supposed to take this upcoming weekend and exercise our rights on this federal holiday to take some time to see where we are in terms of the journey that America is on. Clearly, we still have quite a distance to go, but I do, you know, when I wake up every day, I hope and definitely believe in my heart that we've come a long way in terms of changes that have been instituted and things that have happened since Dr. King's assassination. But, you know, it requires all of us, I think, to be reflective. I remain optimistic about our country and where we're headed, but, you know, things don't change without figures like Dr. King, who, you know, clearly were pivotal in terms of making sure that this country holds the mirror up to itself from time to time and make sure that we understand that we're living up to the principles that we espouse.
Indeed. It could not have been said any better. Well, with that, Malcolm, thank you so much for sharing your time and your subject matter expertise with us. We do understand that you and your family have been going through a very personal, tragic situation. We understand that you guys are going to have to think through that and figure out how to prepare for the future. So with that, understand that Auckland and myself will definitely be keeping you and your family in prayer.
Very much appreciate it. Love you guys, and wish you guys all the best.
Thanks. All right, love you too. Again. Beat Army, man.
All right. Beat Army. Take care, bud.
All right, so that was Mr. M.K. Palmore, who is a retired, as he stressed, assistant special agent in charge with the FBI, who took the opportunity to share some of his experiences with us and a little bit of his perspective on the issues that happened there on Capitol Hill. So, as I said at the beginning, yes, this is a political and community-focused talk show. Sure, most of the times we are taking the perspective as a person who is a Democrat, but we do think that it is important to provide you guys with actual subject matter experts who can provide you with experience and perspective. So with that, we're going to go to our bottom half of the hour break, and then we will be back with Mr. Ben Harris.
It's time for Kennedy for Alabama, a political talk show where we discuss the real issues impacting our sweet home, Alabama. Your calls, comments, and texts are welcome at 251-343-0106.
I love this country. as much, if not more, than you do. And don't you ever forget that.
And now your host, Robert Kennedy Jr.
And welcome back to Kennedy for Alabama. For those of you who are just joining, my name is Robert Kennedy Jr., and I am the host of Kennedy for Alabama. During the first half of the show, we had a very, very detailed and productive conversation with Mr. M.K. Palmore, who is a retired assistant special agent in charge for the Federal Bureau of Investigation. And he took the time to kind of give us his perspective on the events that happened at the United States Capitol last week, both from the perspective of, call it, preparation and security, and then post-event investigative action. So Ben, what did you think about that interview?
Fantastic. It's always good to hear the FBI guys kind of lay out the details of what they do. It is amazing, and their service is incredible.
You know, one of the things that really struck me, and I think this comes off of a lot of the negative PR that came out of some things that happened at the early part of the Trump administration, is this notion that those federal investigative officers are on witch hunts.
It's I'm an attorney and mm-hmm. had my share of dealings with the FBI and the various law enforcement agencies, state, federal, local here, and they're good folks. They really are. Mm-hmm. And the notion, seeing any of them ever demonized is really distressing, I think. And the service, I've certainly gotten to know the local FBI here, and they're just outstanding folks.
Yeah, and most of the interaction that I've had with those guys, I said all the interaction that I've had with them has all been top flight, super sharp group of professionals that have their hearts in the right place and are trying to do the right thing. And again, just like with any other profession, there are a few bad apples, but the few bad apples are not representative of the whole.
Not at all.
So, hey, let's transition a little bit. So for the folks who are not familiar with you, I think the last time that you appeared on the show was at the beginning of this season three. Just talk a little bit about your background and then a little bit about what your responsibility is as the chair of the Democratic Executive Committee.
Sure. I'm born here, and I'm the same age as the Kennedy assassination, for those mm-hmm. who are history buffs. So 57 now. That was a little more interesting when it was the 25th anniversary as opposed to the 57th. But mm-hmm. Grew up here and went off to school and to D.C. for a little bit. And I've been practicing law for, 31 years now,
which is
longer than I ever thought I would do any one thing in my life, but grew up here. My dad's from here. My mother's family is from Virginia, and
okay.
so I've always had a soft spot for that part of the world as well. Got an aunt who lives in Annapolis, thinking of the Naval Academy.
Go Navy.
So, yes. So, and then I'm chairman of the Mobile County Democratic Executive Committee, which is the formal name of the Mobile County Democratic Party.
Okay.
And so we field the local candidates who run, and we're involved obviously also with the state Democratic Party, and support our national candidates as well here when they're on the local ballot.
Okay. So nuts and bolts before we get into the party politics. One of the things that I think that was really surprising to me was just the way that the executive committee party structure tries to bring resources to bear for just running the election, right? Just the mechanics of it. Nothing to do with issues or positions or anything like that whatsoever. So from that perspective, there were some very interesting things that happened here in the state of Alabama, which I think could probably set us up pretty well to continue making some of those changes permanent, right? So there was like the in-person absentee vote. So can you just kind of give us a perspective on that, remind the audience what it was and how it kind of came to be?
Absolutely. We're going to the in-person absentee, which was a really good innovation this year, specifically for the pandemic, the COVID pandemic.
Mm-hmm.
Any registered voter was allowed to vote by absentee ballot without an excuse. In other words,
mm-hmm.
because of the pandemic was the only excuse you needed, I guess maybe is a better way to say that. And you could do it at the Mobile County Courthouse. And for a period of about, what did it start, September 9th or 10th, up through the weekend before the election. And it was a terrific thing. There were lines. I think if you were watching the news, you saw the lines around the block at the courthouse with people lined up to do it. It was a really exciting thing and an exciting time and a new way for people to participate in democracy.
And, you know, it was interesting. I had the opportunity to participate in the public service campaign that was sponsored by Judge Don Davis and the Mobile County Commission. And one of the reasons why I was enthusiastic about doing that was it really stressed that it was an option, that every vote counts, and that this is just another path to give people a little bit more comfort, right, that they could actually execute it. I know Aquilin and I actually ended up voting on Election Day at our normal polling location. But for people who are a little bit more challenged by that because of, you know, work schedules and school schedules and stuff like that, I think it was great that they had another option available to them. And if memory serves me correctly, I think that was Secretary Merrill who said that you could check that first box on the absentee ballot and that you basically would be covered, right? You wouldn't be committing fraud or anything
Correct.
Like that.
Correct. Exactly.
So given that as a background, and you know, there are a lot of things philosophically for us on the Democratic side that we challenge from our Republican majority, those were really two things I think that we got right in this particular cycle. And I love it when Alabama can be a standard of excellence for other folks around the country, and we can identify ourselves as the benchmark on something. And I think we hit the nail on the head with that one.
We certainly did. I think we actually – you could vote earlier in Alabama than anywhere else in the country, if I have that right. And that was really something.
Well, so let's segue to one of the topics right now that is causing a lot of contention. And it's this issue of – call it voter fraud in a broad sense – and the tagline that was being used was "Stop the Steal." And so I actually was asked this question yesterday when I was ping-ponging back and forth with Sean Sullivan on the Midday Show. And so I'll ask you now, how is it that you would give a level of comfort to a bipartisan audience of both Republicans and Democrats if they said they had some concern about the integrity of the election? What would you tell them?
Yeah, well, I would say watch the process. I've had the benefit, of course, being a county party chair, to perhaps see pieces of it that maybe not everybody gets to see. But
right.
The devotion to the task that our folks here in the local elections office, Kim Tillman, who is the head of that office and working under Judge Davis, these people really care about getting it right and watching. You know, there were, I don't remember the exact number, but about 25,000 people who voted by absentee ballot this time, which is about five times more than normal. And every one of those ballots has to be opened and counted, and you've got to run them through the machine, and sometimes the ballots are a little folded up.
Right.
Those folks stayed on election night, stayed till 1:30 or 2 in the morning.
Amazing.
Here in Mobile County to get it right and get everybody's vote counted, and I thought that was very impressive.
Yeah, and you know, you talked about in terms of dedication what you saw there out of that office, but I just think about the volunteers at the local polling stations that we see, and we know these folks because they live in our neighborhood. I've talked about her a number of times. I won't mention her name on air, but my best friend's mom is one of those individuals, and she's a retired school teacher. And whenever someone talks about the notion of fraud, I sit here and think, you know what? What would be the set of circumstances that would cause someone like her to do something improper when she's volunteering to do it in the first place? And we need a whole field of those volunteers in order to make our system work.
It would be virtually, from my perspective watching it, it would be virtually impossible to commit any sort of at least large-scale fraud. In fact, I have a hard time imagining how even a particular ballot could get through that didn't meet all the requirements. There are just too many levels of review, too many levels of checking. And as you say, this is a process that depends on volunteers who simply love our country and care about they're just giving of their time to help us all vote.
Well, the other thing that I thought was interesting, and this is a foil to what we saw at the U.S. Capitol with everything being on video and camera and digital footprints, et cetera, is that if folks were committing fraud at the large scale – now, we know there's some small fraud that happens all the time, mostly in local elections versus national ones – but there would be some paper trail, there would be some video evidence. There would be recorded phone calls. There would be money exchanging hands. You know what I mean? Folks wouldn't be doing that and doing that for free. Now, one of the things that I am very sympathetic to is this notion that because elections are controlled at the state level, that different states have different rules as it pertains to federal elections. And so that part of the argument I actually think is reasonable when you talk about the proximity between a rule change and the actual election day. And I definitely think there's probably the opportunity to do some of that stuff better, but that's not anything that I would define as fraud. I would just define that as a difference of opinion, perhaps.
Correct.
So, the one thing that I wanted to touch on before we went to the break here was this idea of where it is that you start to go from here, right? So we're just before the new legislative session. And is there anything from your perspective as a chair that's kind of top of mind going into that legislative session that you would like to see discussed, evaluated, et cetera?
Well, early voting. I think the tremendous popularity of that in the state, I hope, I certainly don't want to speak for any of our outstanding delegation here, but I certainly hope that there will be some serious consideration given to making permanent the early voting opportunity that this last election showed so many people in Alabama took advantage of and were glad to have.
Yeah, and I think the thing about that really, really struck me, and we'll circle back to the distinction between, call it mail-in voting and absentee voting, but the big thing that I always say whenever we broach this topic is that once you determine that a person is the person that they say they are and they are voting in the correct jurisdiction, we should be doing everything possible to make voting easier, not harder. And that's a combination of any one of different things of mail-in voting, absentee voting, early voting, et cetera, et cetera. So with that, we're going to go to our final break of the evening, and then we'll come back and we'll continue this conversation with Mr. Ben Harris, chair of the Democratic Executive Committee for Mobile.
Welcome back to Kennedy for Alabama. Now let's have a real conversation about what's going on in our Alabama communities. Lines are open at 251-343-0106. Once again, your host, Robert Kennedy Jr.
And we are back for our last 8 minutes, I believe, and 30 seconds of the program. So as we went there into the last break, Mr. Ben Harris and I were talking a little bit about how Alabama set a little bit of a benchmark in terms of how it is from a voting perspective that we responded to the COVID pandemic. And we actually saw that in the results that came out, particularly when it was focused on in-person absentee. And so one of the things we were talking about during the break that I think might be helpful for the listening audience is, Ben, can you just take a second and explain why it is that we should have true early voting versus in-person absentee and why that may be a little bit more convenient, a little bit better for us over the long term?
Certainly. What we had, and I want to commend what we had, which was the in-person absentee, but what early voting would be actually being able to vote a regular ballot early, say 3 weeks. I'm just picking a date, but 3 weeks out from the election, just like you would on election day. This time, we had, absentee, which means you have to go, you fill out an absentee application. For those of you who've done it, it's a cumbersome process. It has to be, but it takes some time. And of course, the officials were reacting to the pandemic in real time. So certainly it was a good solution. But in terms of improving as we learning and improving as we go forward, actual early voting, where you simply go in, show your ID, and you vote, at convenient locations around the county, say two, three weeks out from the election. You're just on your way home from work, say, on your way home from school. You could stop off and vote, and you're finished. And that way, if you have something come up on election day or if you're ill or whatever it is that comes up at the last minute, your vote's already cast. And I think it would increase participation. It certainly increases convenience in our modern society where people are pulled in so many different directions.
Yes.
To be able to do it. And I certainly hope that we can make some progress towards that in this legislative session.
Well, that would be great. I know that's one of the things that we're talking about. We have our, you know, our old standards like, you know, the lottery and what we're going to do with potential, you know, rural broadband and stuff like that. But I think the early voting or making no excuse absentee permanent are two things that have enough legs that we could possibly get those done. So we'll keep our fingers crossed to see whether or not we're able to push that over the finish line. So one of the other things that happened here this week, I know we spent a lot of time talking about last week, was there were articles of impeachment. So with less than a week left, as a matter of fact. So just give me your cut on that. What was your thought as you heard that as a possibility coming up and then seeing it go through? Just kind of what's your reaction?
Well, I think first it's a reaction, and I think an understandable reaction to the events of last week.
Mm-hmm.
An unprecedented assault on the Capitol and on the voting process. I'll never get out of my head the images of the Capitol Hill staff grabbing the boxes of the electoral college ballots and hustling them out.
Wasn't that amazing that somebody had the presence of mind to think about doing that?
But having to do that and having now troops sleeping in the Capitol for the first time since 1861, I don't think we should look past the historical significance of this moment. And I think that it's an understandable reaction, and without getting too deeply into the merits, I think it's something that's going to move forward, and hazard a guess as to the outcome of the vote in the Senate. But I think it's something that many people feel very strongly about, particularly in the halls of Congress.
You know, I talked about this one with Sean Sullivan as well, and my cut was in distinguishing my personal opinion from my political commentary. And I said, from a personal perspective, I thought it's too close to the end to be trying to push it through just practically. But the part that I really wanted to stress was when you look at the implications of not being able to run again, there's this almost spiking the football element to it that we can understand because it's the political world that we live in today. And we don't necessarily want to make it easier for folks on the other side to come back. And the part that I thought was significant in that is I believe there are actually a lot of Republicans who may end up coming along because they want to get back to the core true Republicanism versus Trumpism. And so you may end up finding some people that go along with that. So I don't think it's a foregone conclusion that the conviction will not happen.
I think there's a very good chance. Obviously, I wouldn't, as I say, try to predict.
Not on this one, right?
There's a very, very good chance.
Mm-hmm. So that's that. And then the last thing is probably what is coming up next week. So we actually are going to have an inauguration. And what are your thoughts about what happens once we get beyond the troops being at the Capitol and all that stuff and we've transitioned to a Biden administration?
Well, and I have to say I'm sitting here thinking about something that I guess you'd have to actually be sitting in my shoes to think about. But the Vice President-elect, Kamala Harris, and I share a couple of things. We share a last name.
Yes.
And we were born a few months apart.
Mm-hmm.
So we're essentially the same age. I think we were the same class in school. If you had, when we were born, I was born in 1963. If you had, when we were babies, laid our picture, I'm a white male, born to parents who had been to college and who could send me to college, laid my baby picture next to hers and simply asked people to pick, if you told them in 2021 the vice president would be named Harris and would be one of these two children, when we were born, virtually everyone would have picked me.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
And I think it's a remarkable statement about America that you can't say that now.
Right.
And we haven't made all the progress we need to make, but what a testament to Dr. King. What a testament to all of the foot soldiers of the Civil Rights Movement.
Indeed.
And in fact, to the Vice President's parents, or Vice President-elect's parents, who were very involved. and of course to her and her remarkable career and her remarkable American journey. And if that doesn't fill you with hope for this country, I don't know what does.
Yeah, and I really do appreciate you highlighting that, because as we go here into Martin Luther King Jr. weekend and celebrating his life and legacy, and just thinking about where we are as a country, you know, it's amazing, right? Sure, we were tested last week, and that kind of stretched us a little bit. But as they like to say, this too shall pass. And I often refer to us collectively as we are the children of the civil rights movement. And because of all the things that happened then, we are sitting at this point in our professional and personal lives, and it's an absolutely wonderful place to be. So, yes, we do have work to do. We will continue to do that work, and we will get better for it. So, Ben, thank you so much for joining us this evening. Aqualyn, we appreciate you sharing something good. Phil, we appreciate you doing all the wonderful things you do to keep us sounding good. And to the FM Talk 106.5 listening audience, thank you for giving me this opportunity to share my thoughts with you. Until next time, my name is Robert Kennedy Jr., and you have been listening to Kennedy for Alabama.